Tonight on Arena, Pierce Brosnan, Tom Ellis and Chris Columbus on the Thursday Murder Club. And we review this week's films and look at a new Fringe play, Don't Tell Dad About Diana. It's 51551 if you'd like to text us tonight, or arena at rte.ie. We start tonight with Richard Osman's best-selling novel, the upcoming Netflix film, The Thursday Murder Club. It follows four lively retirees who spend their time solving cold case murders for fun. But their hobby takes a dark turn when they find themselves involved with a real whodunit, where there's a threat to their idyllic retirement community of Cooper's Chase from greedy developers. The film stars Helen Mirren, Ben Kingsley, Celia Imrie and our own Pierce Brosnan, and it's directed by Chris Columbus, the man behind Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire and the first two Harry Potter films. Earlier today, I caught up with director Chris Columbus and with Pierce Brosnan, who plays former trade union boss Ron, and Tom Ellis, who plays his son Jason. But before we hear that, let's hear something from the film. In this scene, the pensioners are trying to mount the barricades led by Pierce Brosnan's rabble-rouser Ron as the bulldozers approach.
Everybody gather round now. We're going to form a human barricade in front of the cemetery, and we're going to be in solidarity with each other. Are we not? Let's do this now. There you go. Stay strong.
Let's not live on our knees, Ron.
I agree, Elizabeth.
We will never surrender.
Thank you, John. Thank you for coming, both of you.
Stop him.
Oh, look at you guys. Well done, lads.
Bernard's recycled an old slogan. Mine's original.
Well, listen now. No argy-bargy between the two of you, OK? Solidarity rules the day. Top man, Ibsen, top man. Joyce, what are you doing? Bringing a coffee machine. This isn't a village fete. This is serious business.
Yes, of course. But good coffee means we can protest longer.
Oh, such a wise woman. Yeah. The enemy approaches!
Pierce Brosnan and Tom Ellis, thanks so much for joining us on Arena tonight. Pierce, you play Ron Ritchie. He's a retired trade union activist. Tell us a little bit about Ron and what it was like playing him.
Oh, I love Ron Ritchie. I mean, he's very close to my heart in many respects. Chris Columbus, who's a dear pal, we made Mrs. Doubtfire, and Percy Jackson. He comes around every now and then with a job for me. I was quite surprised when he was offering me Ron Ritchie, and I didn't ask him why he offered me the role. I just went with it. He said, grow a beard. I grew a beard. You know, my early days as an actor was street performing, and I would do agitprop theatre and stuff like that, and there were political activists. And so I had some kind of backstory in my head of who Ron Ritchie was, and I just had the most glorious summer in the company of all, you know, with Dame Helen and Sir Ben and Tom here playing my son. And, you know, the book is so rich of character and story. And, you know, Chris Columbus is a great director, a great storyteller. So the bonhomie on set was rich.
Tom, you do play Jason, who's Ron's son. People might know you from Lucifer, from the TV series where you play the devil working as a police consultant. I presume you needed a slightly different set of acting muscles for this one.
A very different character, that's for sure. That's why I got into it in the first place, I have to say. Like, I did have a lot of fun playing Lucifer, but I love being an actor to play all these different characters. And having the opportunity to come and work with this dream team was I couldn't pass up that one. And, you know, I saw what Pierce was doing with Ron, and I tried to sort of channel that a little bit into how I was making my choices about playing Jason. And I think we just hit it off, didn't we, and bonded straight away.
We didn't really talk about, you know, the in-depth of the characters. None of us did, really. We showed up on day one and somehow we found a groove. Mm-hmm. I think everyone knew the tone of the film, and Chris Columbus sets that so well. And when you have the quartet of, you know, the characters together, you get so much from each individual actor that they make you real as your character. But no, it was all played with great ease and bonhomie and joy.
Because that does come across on the screen watching the film. It looks like you are all having the most enormous fun while you're doing this.
We were.
We did. I mean, the sun shone every day. Yeah. We all knew that there was a great responsibility at hand to bring to life these characters, which are so deeply loved now by the world. And I don't know. Again, I go back to Chris Columbus. He set the tone. And then everyone was just embraced by that. And also the sets, Cooper's Chase.
Yeah.
James Merriweather, who's the production designer, created this rich, lustrous world for us, which you just kind of fell into. And all the extras, they were magnificent too. So you got so much back every day as an actor.
There was a real sense of community behind the camera as well as on screen as well. And yeah, it just, I don't know, I think we all really enjoyed each other's performances as well, which was, you know, just sitting there like just having fun, essentially.
It was great being with you, Tom, I must say.
Oh,
your dad.
You can do it anytime.
It was so funny, but hopefully again.
The film, despite the subject matter in places, there are murders that happen in the film. It's quite a joyful one, and it celebrates older people. Pierce, I saw you say recently that's something that's quite important.
It is very important because, you know, within our society today, which is going at the speed of light, the elderly can, as we've heard many times, feel invisible. And, you know, we in our culture now, we've stopped nurturing the elders. You know, the circle grows. But it's important to embellish and to understand and bring into our communities the elder folks, you know, who are 70 or 80, 90, and they have a rich wisdom of life. And I think this film celebrates that. Because, you know, and all these four people have inquisitive minds, they have a sensuality, and they have a passion for living.
Maybe one final question for you, Pierce. It's not the first time you've done it, obviously, but do you feel a slightly greater pressure on your shoulder when you are taking on a role that is from a book that is very much beloved and therefore a character that people have in their own minds?
Oh, I'm powerless to do anything, really. I just have to play what's on the page, play what's in the book, and then you give it all your sincerity, your heart, and you do your best work. And then hopefully people will celebrate it.
Pierce Brosnan and Tom Ellis, thanks so much for joining us. Cheers.
Thanks very much.
We're all witnesses to a murder.
First question, then. How do you know it was a murder, not a heart attack? I mean, he was very stressed.
Yes. The probable cause of death was an overdose of fentanyl, administered just before he died. They're waiting for the full lab results now.
Where did you get your information from?
Donna texted me. She's being very helpful indeed.
Where did this fentanyl come from?
Medical professionals use it in anesthesia and pain relief. Very effective on lots of things. But a high dose can be absolutely fatal.
So it had to be someone who had access to needles and drugs, right?
Yes, well, that means almost everybody at Cooper's Chase, Ron.
Chris Columbus, director of the Thursday Murder Club, thanks for joining us on Arena. What was the appeal of this? Why did you want to direct it?
I fell in love with the book. You know, honestly, it was a situation where I've done a couple of successful films based on books. I've done a couple of unsuccessful films based on books. And I realized that the reason the films work is because I'm obsessed with the book. So I read the book and literally fell in love with it. I became a fan and fell in love with the characters. I really didn't approach it as much of a, the murder mystery side of it was interesting. But what I loved about the book is it wasn't your typical sort of cold procedural murder mystery, and it wasn't your over-the-top sort of panto version of a murder mystery. It was really, it was based on these four characters who probably never would have met each other in real life and come together in this particular situation. And I just loved thematically the fact that these are four people facing their own mortality, and then as a result of that, they're obsessed with death and obsessed with murder. I just think part of me finds that funny and part of me finds it really interesting.
Casting is obviously incredibly key in a film like this. How did that go for you? Was that an easy process, a hard process?
It was an easy process only because I think that people responded to the material, the actors responded to the material the same way I did. I remember on Harry Potter when I got the gig, I was reading the book and I would write in the margins my first cast choices. So Maggie Smith and Robbie Coltrane and Richard Harris, and Alan Rickman, and they all said yes. Same thing happened on Thursday Murder Club. I wrote all of these names down and the first choices all said yes, which was hasn't happened in 20 years. Usually your first choice is off doing another film or they're not interested. So I knew we had some sort of special kinship. We had this connection to the material. And that's sort of what started the ball rolling. So it was, I have to honestly say, it's a joy to get your dream cast and to be able to work with them. It's phenomenal.
I want to ask you specifically about Pierce Brosnan because he's Irish. You cast him before in Mrs. Doubtfire 30 odd years ago. How has he changed in the interim as an actor, do you think?
Well, the thing is, I was, I remember the Doubtfire days very well because it was, we had a much different style of filmmaking. It was three scripted takes that Robin and I agreed with, and then Robin would say, we'll play. By playing, he meant improvise, and that would go anywhere from 15 to 25 takes. And as a result of that, I had to shoot part of that film like a documentary because Robin never really knew what he was going to do. I mean, he couldn't tell you what was going to happen when I called action. And when I yelled cut, he couldn't remember what he had done. It was sort of this divine intervention. So I had three cameras on the actors at all times. I had a camera on Pierce, a camera on Sally Field, and one on Robin. And I realized through the course of editing that film and watching it subsequently that Pierce, although playing the straight man, had to play a straight man that well, you have to have an incredible sense of comedic timing. And I realized there's something very funny about this guy that I have not had a chance to tap into. And when I read the character of Ron, which to some people was sort of surprising, why are you casting Pierce Brosnan as Ron? I saw it immediately because I knew how potentially funny and gruff and real Pierce could be.
You're an American. You've directed three Harry Potter films in the UK. You've made another kind of quintessentially British drama in this. What keeps drawing you back to the UK?
I think it started with what I loved about filmmaking, even when I was a teenager. You know, I started to, suddenly they imported the Hammer horror films to America. So I was watching Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, and I became obsessed with them. Then I became obsessed. I'm as obsessed with music as I am with film, and I became obsessed with what we call the British invasion. So it was the Kinks and the Stones and the Beatles eventually. And then I remember seeing A Hard Day's Night for the first time, and that was sort of life-changing. And then I became obsessed with Monty Python. So all of those things were part of my life, and I just felt that it was a world I wanted to enter into. And the first thing I ended up doing was writing young Sherlock Holmes. So as a writer, I sort of began in an interesting way. I can talk about it now. I couldn't talk about it when I was doing Harry Potter, but now I realize that those three kids, the two boys and a girl solving a crime in London, was very similar to what I ended up doing with Harry Potter. So I've just always been obsessed with British culture and art, and as a result of that, I wanted to stay faithful to the actual material, whether it was Potter or Murder Club, you know.
I'm conscious it's very early to ask this question, but there are four Thursday Murder Club novels out there already. There's another one out by the end of the year. Are you going to be part of the sequels? Is it too early to ask that question?
It's only too early to ask because the film hasn't been released. But if the film is released and enough people see it and enjoy it and they clamor for a second one, there's nothing more I'd love to do than work with these actors again. There's not, you know, people are asking me, what else would you like to do? I find it difficult to try to find a better job than actually getting to work with these four. Plus, I honestly got to work with a dream cast. I'd been a fan of David Tennant's for 10 years, and, you know, it started with Broadchurch. And people like Daniel Mays and Jonathan Pryce and Naomi Ackie were all people that I was interested in working with, and to be able to actually sort of live that dream was amazing. And if we get to do a second one, there are other great roles to cast as well. So I just love working here. I really do love it.
Chris Columbus, thanks so much for talking to us on Arena.
Thank you so much.
Knock, knock. May we come in?
Looks like you're already here.
Come for more cake, Inspector.
Elizabeth, no more games, please. This is serious. I'd like to know just exactly how you found this body.
I have already explained this to Donna.
Well, I want to hear it from you.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, you see, I was out for a walk. I was looking for narcissi.
Narcissi?
Oh, daffodil bulbs for my window box.
Your window box?
Yes, for spring colour, you know, next year.
Right,
yes. And I was digging around.
Oh, with your hands?
No, not with my hands. Don't be ridiculous. I had a trowel.
Oh, silly me, a trowel.
It's a trowel for the bulbs.
Of course.
And that was when I found the bones. It was such a shock. It really was the most remarkable coincidence.
And that was Helen Mirren as amateur sleuth Elizabeth Best and Daniel Mays as DCI Chris Hudson in The Thursday Murder Club. You can watch it from Friday of next week, August 28th on Netflix. It's Thursday night, Arena, so time to look at this week's film releases. First up, Eddington, from COVID restrictions to Black Lives Matter. Tensions are high in Ari Aster's sometimes hectic pandemic western, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Pedro Pascal, Emma Stone and Austin Butler. In The Life of Chuck, Tom Hiddleston takes on the title role from a Stephen King novella written and directed by a man who's done a few adaptations in recent times, Mike Flanagan. And finally, Sorry Baby is writer-director Ava Victor's Sundance breakout film, where they also star in a film about the aftermath of a sexual assault. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have been to the cinema first. They join me now in studio. We're going to go to Eddington first, a film that starts in the COVID lockdown of 2020 and the New Mexico town that gives the film its name. Joaquin Phoenix is Sheriff Joe Cross. He's married to Louise, played by Emma Stone. She's one of the reasons he doesn't get along with Mayor Ted Garcia, played by a man who needs to be in 80% of all films this year, Pedro Pascal. Add to the combustible mix, Austin Butler as a charismatic cult leader, Vernon Jefferson Peake. So the sheriff and the mayor don't get along, even before the sheriff takes it upon himself to run against the mayor in the next election. Who doesn't want to hear Joaquin Phoenix and Pedro Pascal square up to one another?
We never talked about it. No. Can we just talk? Can we just the two of us?
We are.
Okay. So maybe I just talk to your video. Ask where all your deputies went.
Okay. Well, why don't I just ask your governor about her little catch and release policy, okay? Because if it wasn't for that, maybe I could hold on to my deputies and the people we arrest.
I know one of them was fired for excessive force, and another one was forced to quit by a YouTube First Amendment auditor.
Okay, yes, that is the same auditor that drove away your work.
Your undersheriff died of a fentanyl overdose.
From handling fentanyl.
And your captain. And your chief deputy took jobs in Rio Rancho.
That was devastating.
You can't keep your own office going, but you're going to run mine. Leave your mess here and start a whole new one.
I'm having flashbacks. It's like witnessing an argument on Twitter. Ruth, there's a lot going on in this film. It brings us back to the pandemic and starts with to mask or not to mask.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you're not actually asking me to provide a synopsis. You did it very nicely yourself. And you couldn't, like, if you even started to include every single thing that was in this film in a description of it, we'd be here, you know, throughout most of the rest of the day. And it would feel, indeed, as long as this film felt to me by the time I'd got to the end of it. So, yep, we're at the beginning. We're in 2020, COVID lockdown. And Joaquin Phoenix, who is, of course, always larger than life in any role that he occupies, and he occupies this with force and vigour, he is the mayor. So it is a Western. He's the mayor in this, you know, small town, classic Western setting. He's up against, or he's the sheriff, rather. He's up against the mayor, who played by Pedro Pascal, as you said, and we just had that clip, where they just start iterating all the things that are happening in their kind of multiverse. And every single touch point that you could trigger comes up within probably the first 5 minutes. But you've got, you know, you've got mask wearing, not mask wearing. You've got, we're later going to get the building of a data center. We've got Black Lives Matter comes up. We've got sexual abuse comes up. We've got the crazy mother-in-law who's at home watching Facebook and all the conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theories.
Would you like to take over, Paul? Because actually, I don't think I can get the end of this one.
He is throwing everything at the wall and seeing
it feels like it might be a two-hander here, just the explaining of the film itself.
Yeah, the
He decides to run for mayor because he's so exasperated with Pedro Pascal's character, the mayor, who's this he's actually good in it, although he's underused like almost everybody except Joaquin Phoenix, who's really overused. But he has a beef with him to do with his wife, is played by Emma Stone, and he decides to run. And his campaign is endearingly shambolic because Pedro Pascal is slick, as he always is, and there's this wonderful campaign. And I actually probably would have voted for him and then regretted it afterwards. and I would never in a million years vote for Joaquin Phoenix to run anything. But he has this his anti-COVID stance. It's not anti. It's anti-lockdown. This film is coherent and interesting for an hour. And what's interesting is all that it brings up about that in a funny way, because I felt like a lot of Irish people, like an obedient sheep during our lockdowns, and I didn't really question them. I thought, this is for the greater good. And then about 3 years later, I thought, was it for the greatest good? And I think probably that's a very Irish response to it. And so all of that stuff about, you know, freedom of movement versus this, that and the other, and, you know, the rights of the individual, that was all really good. And some of the acting is very good in bits and pieces. And then it just turns into a kind of Sam Peckinpah film on Red Bull. And he does this, though, Ari Aster, he does this.
I want to take a clip of, as you said, his endearingly shambolic attempt to throw his hat into the ring for the town mayor contest. This is Joaquin Phoenix.
Is it worth it to combat a virus that isn't even here at the cost of being at war with your neighbors and your family? Because that's what community is, isn't it? It's a family, okay? Because you can ruin a man's day, or you can do the right thing, and you can be kind, and you can free his heart. We need to free each other's hearts. And that's why I'm running for mayor. Mayor of Eddington.
Did he just say what I think he said?
I have served this county as sheriff for 7 years, and it has been my honor, and I would be honored to serve you as mayor.
That's Joaquin Phoenix's Sheriff Joe Cross in Eddington. Ruth, as Paul has alluded to it, it starts to get ugly in varying degrees. It ramps up, and then things turn much worse.
Yeah, at about the two-hour mark, this is a long film, at about the two-hour mark, the film takes a sudden turn, and an event happens that I won't say what it is, but you don't expect it. And it's not, I think the problem with this is the film hasn't led you to expect it, so it doesn't have an internal coherence that if a narrative takes a turn, you're going, okay, you know.
And
it just
his character's not coherent either.
No, it's not. It's completely. No. He is just a mouthpiece for a set of opinions, many, many sets of opinions. So it takes his turn. It goes into this kind of, as you say, sort of Sam Peckinpah-ish violent mode. Then it's like the horror movie almost where you know somebody won't die basically because he's basically rampaging around the town shooting. And his victim won't die, and he keeps shooting them, and he doesn't die. But how can this is a film thing? How can you keep shooting somebody and they don't die? But it goes on and it goes on and it goes on, and it's, you know, it is actually in many ways a fantastically well made film.
All his films are. He's technically very good.
Very good, and it's also got the what's in the that really great cinematographer
Darius Conji.
Darius Conji, yeah. And the place looks amazing. It looks, you know, on the big screen.
But its idea is at the expense of character, just as Beau is Afraid was, which was more pretentious than this. But for instance, you've got Austin Butler, who he gets better and better every time you see him, and he comes in this Vernon Peak character, this really interesting kind of creepy messianic cult leader, and then we hardly see him ever again, and there is a whole little sub story to be told there, but it's not really told, and that happens again and again and again in the film.
And that's also the Emma Stone bit as well, yeah. Because I mean he's got Emma Stone, who's such a fantastic actor. He gives her this miserable whingy part. Okay, so the woman suffers from mental health issues and it's incredibly predictable, she doesn't have much to do, and then the payoff for all of this, which is, you know, when she runs off with him, I'm not giving away much without the Austin Butler character, is the payoff is just nauseatingly predictable. And you think, How
the
could
mother,
you do
though,
this?
The mother, though, is great. Deirdre O'Connor plays Emma Stone's mother.
And
she's an almost likable conspiracy theorist, if that wasn't a contradiction in terms. And she's really funny in it.
Yeah, people might remember her if they watch the Penguin series, because she plays Colin Farrell's mother in that as well.
Yeah, she's great in that too. Yeah.
She has great moments in this. She's only allowed some moments.
Yeah.
You're at the data center plot.
Data center, yeah.
Also, kind of at the very beginning, it's you're led to believe that that's quite an important part of it, and then it disappears.
It's well, you kind of think that he's gonna, you know, take on Trump, like, you know, that he's actually going to address the very large problem at the middle of American society, but he doesn't. He doesn't do that. So it's kind of,
yeah, I mean, they're kind of MAGA style rallies, you get it, right? Yeah. Because of the clothing, but he never mentioned Trump in the whole thing.
No, what? And he makes much more fun of the earnest white middle class students who decide they're Black Lives Matter activists, and he's kind of sort of mean spirited about them. And gives them a worse time than anybody else.
I think he was just
trying to do too many things.
But why not? If you're going to throw everything in, why not throw in Trump as well?
Yeah.
And it seemed to me he ran scared a little bit of actually name-checking Trump amidst all of this.
I'm reticent to ask, but I have to because it's part of the job. How many stars, Ruth? What did you think?
Well, you know, I thought it had a lot of ambition. And I agree with Paul that the first half was really interesting. The second half just went off the rails. So I gave it 3 out of 5. And for cinematography as well.
Okay, Paul.
The second half annoyed me so much that I gave it 2 stars.
Negative marking.
We should point out to people it is quite long. It's 2 hours 47.
But people will expect this because his last film was this long. So it is long. It is long.
But
some people will like
it.
Yeah. Well, if you're a fan, for instance, of, let's say, Midsommar or Hereditary, some of Ari Aster's previous films, is this going to do anything for you, do you think?
Yes, it will. And if you were able to sit through Bo is Afraid, you'll definitely be able to sit through this. And it's not dull.
And I think there is also a message there, which is, Hollywood has always solved problems. At the end, the sheriff sorts out the problem in the small town and rides off into the sunset. And I think Astor's saying that can't happen any longer because the problems have got so huge and that they're insoluble. And so that's why I'm not offering you solutions to the problems I'm throwing up.
Okay,
that may be a charitable reading.
It may be. We're going to take a look at The Life of Chuck, Mike Flanagan's new film based on a Stephen King novella, and Ava Victor's Sorry Baby, but an ish toshi nam to nocht le Marian Nihulo.
Gormaga the Rick agus gamani diarib. Exi specialta gahurt du hirlun mala gon de hebradarn tronona kushiv Nathan Hanlon, namely on the de guish, as Ivrihian, Rarka Hushlan, Mali Nail, a garrick nashure, and nun waro Ian Welch, namely on the gustahid guish, or friu basia in the hachkuni, a garrick nashure, a dusna misisha, kudushirfi chanella, a gaspecia eresh, os corn the kurtsa erisht, de marcha huggin. There tintanish de Simon Harris will fall to riven silerach de tasa going to tradala idirentis na Europagus America file chivanyov, fui garata awan, gochugdeg fingaid, antalya tradala vehera yara ari, eves chaganach deg America o hiris in Europe. There tintad Harris freshen, gul galun tiananish, gerben rata tradala sha, vehera yara ari kogashirte, agas avid lectracha, etanan lectrachas, echola frihub. There's uachter an chmishun the Europa Ursula von der Leyen nachul zedele she brushes fos agus gilianach efigin the Europa Arab amun koratilish the Americani le sacrihe yena fitile laidu har Natali Tradala. Tá garda bhfuil fisrúchan ar bun faoi ó híh bás féidir lár chairhlá clia chur ar finraí ón chadaibre. Wása fear blian le cosin leichéad in teachtain seo, go bhhar an roch ortaiche sa gleigan na bhainghó nar a leagú go tála, gargan hala déon ar rádaí chonail de hína seo caite. Bhí bainte garda leis a gás agus gá réid, tá fisrúchan neamhsplach ar bun faoi ag efig ombudsman na bólíní fisrú. Cha cuairt America amach an pianos go chéirichéad ches go $4 million a gearú ar an uachtar an Donald Trump a gás sívélta. Iar breithef an pianos ar Donald Trump nir a fríú cintacha as ólas míchrín i chuairt fuin na chadrachmus le go gahaí go gríú leis nir a bheith sé fáil iasachtaí banc nó a pléile cuairsaí árachas. Ach rialaíh a gúirt achúirc i stát nó áirach gur an ínal airigid i gearú ar róhéir ach níor curú éon áru ar bhreithúnas an cháis. an aim sir fanna sé tirim an chadéileg an tróna agus be meascán go tréifhsí scamlacha agus tréifhsí gréinán. Fanna sé tirim mór an chulaicheart a nacht freisin agus be rinnt peistí ceónú ceobhránán rihhainechan an lé go háid i níorthar na tíre. Idir 10 géim agus 5-10 Celsius bheits an tuchtas isle. Ba bhinn iad príomhscéalta na nuachta agus an aim sir fuilaithir ar ais ina sé gric.
Gura mahagot a wari, and you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington are in studio with me taking a look at this week's film. The Life of Chuck is a story told in three acts and based on a 2020 novella by Stephen King. Paul, what would Mike Flanagan, the writer and director, do without Stephen King?
What indeed, yeah, he's been to the well many times, and this actually is, this is a 2020 novella, I think, as part of a collection, and to me, the best Stephen King adaptations have been free with the form and have moved away from it. And I know Stephen King has softened slightly, but hates The Shining. And I think you were saying in the All Fair that this on the side of a bus, so this was the best ever Stephen Smith adaptation, maybe the 16th best or the 17th best.
Okay.
But so it sticks literally to the storyline, which is told in three distinct parts, and maybe it had to if it was going to adapt it. And in the first part, everybody wants to know who Chuck is. Basically, bad things are happening in the world. You know, there's some extreme weather events. It feels apocalyptic, to be perfectly honest, to suit the current mood. And Chiwetel Ejiofor plays Marty Anderson, this high school teacher, and he is trying to interest his students in English literature, and at the same time he's worrying about the state of the world. He's walking home, people are getting out of their cars, stars are falling from the sky, which is very worrying, and he goes to visit his ex-girlfriend who's played by, or his ex-wife who's played by Karen Gillan, who's actually very good in it, Felicia she is. And they wonder who this Chuck Krantz is. There's been all these, they've seen all these ads on the sides of buses and on TV, these flash ads, 39 glorious years. Who is he? They don't know. Meanwhile, the world is ending. Then in the second part of the story, we actually get to meet Chuck as an adult, who's played by Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah, where do we go from there, Ruth? Because that's where Tom Hiddleston comes in the second part.
Yes, well, we go into a completely different movie at that point. So he is dressed, he's a neat man, the actor Tom Hiddleston. He's dressed very neatly in a business suit. He approaches a group of people who are gathered around a drummer who's busking. She starts to play a tune and she's kind of just warming up. He starts to dance, and it turns out he's a fantastic dancer. So, and then he pulls in another onlooker who's beginning to kind of move with the music. So she dances with him,
it's a lovely scene.
It's a really nice. And it goes on. It's about 10. You know, it's about 10 minutes long. The sequence. This is the bit I like best of the movie, because they dance together, and then eventually the three of them with the drummer, they go off, they have this little walk. There's this kind of sense of an attraction, but it's not really. It's just a moment that they've had. She's just broken up with her boyfriend. And so it all comes together at this sequence, and you know who Chuck is, though we don't know still why he's on the billboards and why the world's coming to an end. And we don't know why he dances, because that will be revealed
in the third part. And in the third part, we find out that Chuck is played by two different actors as a child, and then as a late teenager. And we find out that unfortunately his parents died in a car crash, which I think tends to happen in Stephen King's.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of car crashes.
And so he's brought up, but luckily for him, his grandparents, who are very nice. Mark Hamill plays the grandfather, and the grandmother is played by Mia Sara, who's great as well. Mm. And she teaches him to dance. His granddad teaches him to love numbers, which I wish somebody had done for me. And his grandmother teaches him to dance. And he actually has a sort of lovely, charmed childhood. But there's a locked door at the top of the house.
That's a very Stephen King moment.
It's totally Stephen King. He must never go into it, and of course he does go into it. And that explains a tremendous amount all of a sudden about what has been going on.
Okay, I want to take a clip from the film. This is Katie Siegel as his teacher, Ms. Richards, and Jacob Tremblay as the young Chuck.
What's in there between my hands?
My brain.
No, that's not exactly what I mean. What's in there right between my hands right now?
I don't know.
All the people you know?
I guess.
Just the people you know? Everything you see. Everything you know. The world, Chuck. Planes in the sky. Faces. Real and imagined. You understand? Don't stop there. You fill the whole thing with everyone you ever meet, everyone you ever know, everyone you ever just imagine. It'll be a universe. A whole universe right between my hands. You contain multitudes.
Which you were telling me earlier is also one of the keys to the
this
film.
Is the key to Ruth. this exchange is key to the entire message of the film, because in our lives we contain multitudes, we meet multitudes of people. And so I think if I'm correct, when he dies, the world comes to an end, because it's his world that contains multitudes that's coming to an end.
I'm going to move on, I think, and ask you what you made of this. Give me some stars.
Well, the large problem I had with this was there was so much writing in it and narration. You can do this well, as we know from a certain film called Shawshank Redemption, and you have Morgan Freeman, but Nick Offerman was doing the narration here, and we were told everything we were supposed to think about everything all the way through the film, and I found it very tiresome. As I mentioned to you off air, other people who disagree, there were other people who saw it the same time I saw it, thought it was wonderful and moving, but I did not. So I give it 2 stars.
Okay, Ruth?
I went a generous 3 because I really did enjoy the middle sequence, and I thought Tom Hiddleston was great. I wish we'd seen more of him as an actor in it. So I went to 3 for that. But again, I mean, I really get it. For some people, this is meaningful. But for me, it was utterly meaningless and trite and rather kind of sickly.
And that is the life of Chuck. Finally, to Sorry Baby, Ava Victor writes, directs and plays the lead in their debut feature film. They play Agnes, a professor of English at a university in New England, where a visit from an old friend brings up old trauma, a sexual assault that she suffered as a postgrad. Ruth, this is told out of sequence as well, but for very different reasons. Where does this film start?
First of all, I love this film, but it starts off with two old friends who are meeting up after their college years. And one of them, Eva Victor, who is the director, also plays the lead in it, Agnes. And she's meeting up with her old friend, Lydie, who's played by Naomi Aki, who's the English actor, who's fantastic in it.
They're great together.
Really good. They've got a really lovely rapport. They're meeting up after a number of years. We kind of get the sense that Agnes is something of a recluse. She's in her own home. She's not coming out that much. She has to be really encouraged to come out for an evening to get together with some of the other students. And then there's references to the thing. And we don't know what the thing is, but they're referring to it. And at this point, too, I'm not really giving anything away. Lydie has a secret that she wants to tell her as well. That's why she's come to do it. But the reason then that we go into other time flashbacks is the thing, and again, I'm not giving anything away because this is what it's about, is that she was sexually assaulted by her male university professor. And then, of course, I suppose it's this idea that trauma comes to you in flashbacks. So the way to kind of convey trauma is not as a linear process of event to healing, if you can do that. But you have these moments where you remember things and you have something happens and it triggers it. And then life goes on in a kind of normal way. So that's what the film is doing the whole way through. It's telling us the story, but in these kind of moments.
And it does it in a very interesting way
as
well.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
Because it presents, you know, these trauma cliches are not in it. And so the character's not presented as a sort of destroyed victim. She's a person. She's still herself. And there are moments where she forgets to think about it. Lots of moments where she forgets to think about it. And so we sort of get to know her after that better than we did before it. And just by increments, bits and pieces, occasional contact with humanity, as she does in a beautiful scene with John Carroll Lynch, she starts to feel that everything is not terrible. She has two wonderful monologues, sort of Hamlet-like, Hamlet in a skull. One is with a cat who she adopts, and she tells us about the terms and conditions of their new arrangement. And then this wonderful, wonderfully written sequence at the end where she takes her friend's baby, she's had a baby, and she takes her baby and she talks to it about how the world's going to be, how adulthood will probably suck, but that you'll be able to manage it.
I want to take a clip from the film, and it does come from earlier on, and it is Agnes in the supermarket with her newly found emotional support kitten, who she's just found on the side of the road.
Hey. Is this all for you today?
Yes, thank you.
Did you bring a cat into the grocery store?
No.
Yes, you did.
What did you say?
You're lying.
No, I'm not.
Is your cat food?
I talked to Ava Victor earlier in the week here on the programme, and she talked about this. It's important, Ruth, to say that the assault itself isn't shown at all in the film. It is something that happens entirely elsewhere. What did you make of that decision?
I thought that was really great because it doesn't then make it spectacular. And it means that we have to... She actually tells her friend afterwards what happened in detail. But all we see is her going into the house, the lights dimming, obviously time's back, then her coming out in an obviously traumatised state.
The way she talks about it is great because she's coming to terms with it in real time. She's actually realising what happened as she tells her friend.
And then there's bits missing as well. Yeah. She can't quite remember exactly what happens, which is so realistic. Mm. But she conveys that so incredibly well, the character. And so by not making this the kind of focal point of the film, it means that we're not being kind of... We're not being sort of voyeuristically drawn into it. We're going with the story. And again, I think, you know, that cat sequence is great because it's really funny. And one
that's
of the
thing about the film.
About
it sounds it sounds like it's going to be miserablest, and it's a very funny film. It's a very witty film.
Yeah, very American Indie in that sense. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Can I get stars out of five from both of you, please?
No, I'll go. Yeah, I give it 4 out of 5. One or two things I thought could have been tightened up, but I thought it was really good. I really, really liked it.
Okay, Paul.
Swinging wildly between moods this week. I'm 5 stars for this. I didn't have any fault with it whatsoever, and I thought it was really original as well.
Okay, if you're interested in a little bit more, I did speak to Ava Victor earlier this week on Arena. You can listen back wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington, thanks as usual. It's August time, and in a rite of passage all over the country, teenagers are making plans for their new lives post-exams. A brand new play called Don't Tell Dad About Diana, which has been selling out at this year's Edinburgh Fringe, tells the story of two Irish teenagers, best friends Connor and Hannah, who are desperate to leave Dublin for the bright lights of London. But first, they're to perform in the alternative Miss Ireland drag contest as Connor's alter ego, Princess Diana, for which Hannah has done the amazing costumes, including a so-called revenge dress. However, it is August 1997. The real Princess Diana is in the Mediterranean with her new boyfriend Dodi and is about to return to Paris. And Connor has a secret that he has yet to reveal to Hannah. Joining me now from Edinburgh are Hannah Power and Connor Murray. Welcome to Arena, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. I'm glad you could come on. You're about to come back to Dublin as part of the Fringe Theatre Festival here, but congratulations on the reviews at Edinburgh. At the moment, you've been performing to sold-out audiences. I'm interested, has that been happening in the traditional Edinburgh Fringe fashion where you open to smaller audiences and then there's word of mouth and by the end, hopefully, you're selling out?
Yeah, we kind of... didn't have much of a plan. We didn't have actually even a budget for posters coming up here. We were just hoping for the best, and the word of mouth just really spread and on socials too. So we actually have been selling out for the last 2 weeks, and we increased our capacity for this final weekend and it's sold out. So we're delighted.
Connor, tell me about the play itself, about the story.
So the play itself, it's set in 1997 and it follows these two friends and it's kind of a wild journey through Dublin from preparations for the Alternative Miss Ireland competition leading up to competition night. And obviously, as we know, what happens in August 97, tragedy strikes, and it kind of marks the unravelling of their friendship and their plans to leave Ireland. We just thought 1997 was such a rich year to choose from and write a story about friendship from. So it's a coming of age tale with a lot of heart, and at its core it's a story about friendship.
I'm going to sound incredibly old here and probably not for the last time on this programme. How much did you know about 1997, given that I'm fairly sure neither of you were born in 1997, and about Diana? Maybe Hannah, you can tell me about that.
Not much, if I'm honest. I was born the next year, so it actually all started when we watched an episode of Really in the Years. And we just thought it was such a camp, fun year. Like the first gay kiss on Fair City, Boyzone and Spice Girls were all over the charts. There was Eurovision and, of course, Diana. So that's kind of where the inspiration came from. But we did a lot of research. We went to the Irish Queer Archive in the National Library. And then we just watched a lot of interviews of Diana and read lots of articles as well.
Is that a fun thing to do, Connor, the research as part of something like this?
I think the research part is so fun because there's so much that you throw out and you don't use, but you go into these like deep, mm-hmm. deep dives on something you know really nothing about. We were very lucky. We had like 2 weeks development with Claire McGuire to help us kind of build a really rich world and rich characters. And that was kind of where most of that research came out. We had walls covered in post-it notes and posters and pictures and, you know, things we'd taken from the queer archives. We put up the Pride Parade and stuff. And yeah, it's such a brilliant thing. And also it just makes the world of the play, I think, really rich. It's kind of imbued with all different things that we learned along that way.
Connor is gay in the play. The life for gay men and women was very different in 1997 than it is now. But Connor's not struggling with his sexuality, is he? Why did you want his sexuality not to be the point of the play?
I think because I guess we write from, in some ways, our own experience where it wasn't necessarily a problem for me, as in that I had such strong friendships in my life that made me feel loved and like that I wasn't the problem. It was the world around me that was the problem. So we kind of wanted to imbue that in the story as well, that we're in their bedroom with them. We're following their story. This is their safe space and it's full of joy and happiness. And the outside world is something that needs to catch up with them. It's not the other way around.
I'm conscious, Hannah, that I haven't really scrolled back here. How did the two of you meet and then how did that lead to the two of you writing the play?
So we met in Trinity studying drama. Connor was just in the year above me. And then we both ended up going to Mountview, which is a drama school in London at the same time. And we've kind of been codependent and inseparable since. But yeah, we started writing it towards the end of our year at Mountview. We knew that we wanted to write together. And I think also spending a year explaining Irish history to English people really brought out the kind of nationalist side of both of us, which inspired the script also.
What's it like writing something like this then with such a close friend? I think I'm interested in what both of you have to say about this, Connor.
It's, you know, it's very fun. And actually kind of the central dilemma of the play, whether you leave and make a life for yourself somewhere else or whether you stay and try and build something better where you are, kind of rings true in our friendship. I'm in Dublin, Hannah's in London, so this was a lovely way to stay in contact really regularly and mainly be creative together. We're in contact every day anyway, but just to get to be creative together. And it's so fun building a world with your friend. And also there's no tiptoeing around what you really think. We say what we feel, we say it in the moment, we shoot from the hip, and then we kind of deal with the consequences of that after. And I think it's a really safe way. You know, sometimes in creative relationships, you have to spend a long time building up the trust to be able to say what you think, whereas that was just automatically there with us, I think.
Does that mean, Hannah, then that your friendship and your creative relationship end up becoming one and the same? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's great. Yeah, I definitely think they feed into each other. I think a lot of audience reviews like talk about the chemistry Connor and I have on stage. And I think that comes from the really close friendship we have. So it's really nice. I feel so comfortable going on stage with Connor, like knowing he has my back, which is lovely.
And as the play moves on, tell us a little bit more about that, because obviously the two main characters in it are preparing for the alternative Miss Ireland contest, and the closer they get to that, things become more fraught, and then it obviously all comes to a head.
It does. We were really interested in exploring the idea that sometimes the first heartbreak that you have can come from a friendship rather than a romantic love. And that, you know, someone that you've spent so much time with, you go over to their house after school all the time, you talk every day, and that there comes a point that you are kind of not outgrowing each other, but growing in different directions and kind of finding a way to work through that, or finding a way to make a friendship live beyond living beside each other, going to school together every day. So, yeah, we were really interested in like that formative friendship on the cusp of a really big change.
I'm interested. Shirley Temple Barr is a character in this. Have you had any conversations with her about this?
Yeah, she won the Alternative Miss Ireland in 97. That's true. It's a fact. So we touched base with her and sent her the script. We highlighted everywhere that she was mentioned in it, and she is such a good sport. She's also incredible. Sunday bingo down in the George. I've been many a time, and yeah, she is great crack.
We are big fans of her. In the script, she is our enemy, but that's not true in real life.
Yeah. I mean, she's also agreed to make a voice cameo in the Dublin version. So she'll actually announce the winner of Alternative Miss Ireland in the Dublin version. So she is a really good sport, and we're very grateful to her for doing that.
I'm interested to know about the arc that maybe the two of you have gone through from the process of writing it to deciding you're going to Edinburgh, realising that you don't have an enormous budget, to then starting to sell out rooms and then having to put it into a slightly bigger location. That must put a pressure on both of you. Hannah?
I think I felt pressure in the second week of Fringe, just because I'm not sure how it's going to go, and you've put so much into it and you're kind of waiting for reviews to come out. But then we obviously are so lucky. The response has been amazing. And since then, I've just been trying to enjoy it and be present and have fun here and also see other shows. Yeah, because we've just had the best Fringe experience. So,
and I have to put in and say that Hannah is very much a big part of why we're here, because I would kind of be maybe the more cautious one and more afraid to take the leap. And she was just, we both felt the story would thrive here, but she's the one who really took my hand and was like, let's do this. This is something we have to do. And I'm so glad that we have.
And in terms of bringing it to the Fringe in Dublin, then, does that add a slightly greater layer of pressure to it, or the pressure that maybe you don't have already? Either Hannah or Connor.
I think bringing it back to Dublin, it feels like a bit of a homecoming. I'm excited for things that go amiss in this run, or they're glossed over, for like certain references to be really picked up at home.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's a fun story. It's very descriptive. It's very narrative focused. So I think that a Dublin audience will really be able to come on that journey with us, in Bewley's. Very, very excited to get it home and up on stage there.
And Hannah, what would you like people to take away from this when they've seen it?
I would like people to just enjoy spending an hour at the theatre and be taken on a journey with two friends, and maybe think about friendships in their own life and how much they mean to them.
And are you working on anything else, or is this entirely your focus for now, Hannah?
This has been very much our focus for the last few months. To get here, we did a couple of work in progress versions in Smock Alley Theatre, and then in Pleasance in London, and then in Camden People's Theatre again in London, just to get the script to the place that it is now. So it's been a lot of work, and also we've had an amazing team helping us along the way. Emma Finnegan is our director, and we've had Roa Barron helping us with producing work. We couldn't have done it without them or the rest of the team.
And Theo and Gabe and Ferdy on our tech team, they actually came with us through all of those works and progresses. So they've really helped us build that world, especially on a fringe stage where it can be quite bare, like the lights and the sound and the set. Gabe, Ferdy and Theo have just worked absolute magic with very limited budget, as we've said before, and they haven't let that stop them. They've made it really rich and fun, and it's yeah, we're incredibly grateful to them.
Well, as I said earlier on, you're in the middle of a sold out run. Thanks a million for taking the time to talk to us tonight on Arena. Don't Tell Dad About Diana by Hannah Power and Conor Murray will be at the Bewley's Cafe Theatre from the 8th of September to the 13th. There are lunchtime and evening shows, and for more information, the Fringe website is fringefest.com. That's it for tonight's Arena, produced by Reg Luby. Paula Shields did the research. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, and our sound supervision by Liam Mullen. Tonight I'm Rick O'Shea, and I'll talk to you again from 6:30 tomorrow evening, when we'll take a look at this week's new music and new TV. John Creedon is next.